Hey, Randy, what's going on?
Good evening, Jim.
What amazing things do you think we should talk about tonight?
Well, you have had an interest lately in this consistent history's interpretation of quantum mechanics. Did you get that from a mention in a Lee Smolin book?
Yes, I did get this from reading Three Roads to Quantum Gravity. The guy who invented this consistent quantum theory interpretation, Robert Griffiths, was mentioned in that book, and so was the consistent history's interpretation of quantum mechanics. Although what I was reading from Lee Smolin was a much different thing than what we've read in these two papers by Robert Griffiths that we're looking at today, one of which is EPR, Bell, and Quantum Locality, and the other one was Consistent Quantum Measurements. And I'm trying to think. One of those is from the American Journal of Physics, the EPR, Bell, and Quantum Locality, and I forget where Consistent Quantum Measurements is from.
But it's recent, though. Those two papers are from 2011 and 2015, respectively. So this is a pretty new arrival on the theoretical scene.
Well, I think Robert Griffith's first paper on the consistent histories, he introduces it in like 1986, I think. So it's been bubbling around for quite a long time. And it's something that Lee Smolin thought was a good way to think about quantum theory that was consistent with, say, loop quantum gravity. That was part of the reason why I wanted to look at this. One was because we've already talked about quantum interpretations in some detail in de Broglie-Bohm interpretation. Also, we've talked about, you know, the entire range of quantum metaphysics in the Physics FM podcast. I thought this would be a good way to move towards that loop quantum gravity or anything talking about what the vacuum really is, which is why we want to get into that loop quantum gravity, because that's one way to think about what is the vacuum really. And I think that is going to show up somewhere in these papers, is what is the vacuum. It's going to be important for understanding what's going on with some stuff later on.
I don't think I really recall these papers touching on that idea. Did I miss something? Talking about the quantum vacuum, I mean?
In Consistent Quantum Measurements, when he's talking about how Bohmian mechanics interprets what happens, he introduces thought experiment, and that thought experiment does rest on what this vacuum stuff really is. Is the vacuum nothing, or is it something?
Yeah, with Bohmian mechanics, it's like a seething sea of pilot waves, right?
Yeah, so in Bohmian mechanics, the vacuum should be this pilot wave, these oscillations in the vacuum. Sure, if that's really how Bohm thought about it, but that's one way to look at it. Oscillations in the vacuum, and these particles bouncing around in that four-dimensional sea. Whereas when we get to this discussion later on, it looks like Griffiths is looking at the vacuum as a classical vacuum, that is, with just sort of empty space with nothing in it.
That's consistent with what we've talked about recently in terms of like kind of debunking the idea of quantum vacuum fluctuations.
How do we debunk the quantum vacuum fluctuations other than saying that it's probably not the cause of dark energy?
Well, we talked about how you can model the Casimir effect, which is always cited as the most physical proof of the vacuum fluctuations, as a dipolar interaction at the molecular level, right? With using relativistic math.
Okay, yeah, and so that's trying to pull out some of the experimental rationale, sort of pull the rug out under the experimental rationale for the quantum vacuum fluctuations. The big problem with that still is that those quantum vacuum fluctuations just show up in quantum electrodynamics, which is a very successful theory. The thing I don't like about quantum vacuum fluctuations is because people just use it as an excuse to justify any old random thing. We've talked about seven different things that people say are based on the quantum vacuum. Don't quote me on that. I just remember somewhere around, you know, episodes 10 through 16, we talked about them at least 3 to 7 times. I just remember we talked about them a lot, and things at some point, things were just getting more and more preposterous whenever you brought them up. But that's fine. I mean, you know, that doesn't mean they aren't there. It just means that people want to use them as a justification for just about anything. But that doesn't mean there aren't quantum vacuum fluctuations. It also doesn't mean that there isn't something else like that. There isn't something else in the vacuum that could act like that Bohmian sea.
Yeah, what's interesting about that is it seems like whatever is guiding that wave equation is not like an energy. It seems like it's something more abstract than that in Bohmian mechanics.
Well, have you seen a calculation for Bohmian mechanics on how large that energy should be?
Oh, no, I was just thinking about looking at the math for the Bohmian model, and there was a specific term which defined the pilot wave, which seemed to be different than an energy term, like we, you normally look at EM fields. It seemed to be kind of abstract. It didn't seem to have like a certain, like a equation of state, like a fluid or anything like that.
If you can find some of those things out, we can talk a little bit about that. Anyways, Lee Smolin was talking about this consistent histories approach to quantum mechanics because it's consistent with the way he's thinking about loop quantum gravity, which is a way of talking about what's in the vacuum.
So in loop quantum gravity, they don't have like a field of vacuum fluctuations like you hear in so many pop science articles.
Well, I don't know enough about what it says there is there, but there are supposedly these connections in space. These connections make the loops and stuff like that. So I'm trying to work us towards that because you wanted to talk about what is actually in the vacuum. What are the theories of the vacuum? And so I'm trying to go basically from what we've done before towards where people are doing other things. And that's part of what this is about. Another thing is that a lot of people like this interpretation, and I hadn't really heard about it before I read that book by Lee Smolin. So I wanted to read a little bit about it and see what was going on with it.
I'm really intrigued with it because it seems to make sense and seems pretty intuitive, and it thankfully seems to pretty much contradict the Copenhagen interpretation, which he oddly refutes it in his second paper, but we'll get into that later. And he's saying that it's a local interpretation, and it seems to cut out a lot of mysticism in quantum theory, so I did enjoy reading about it. I'm a little bit confused about how it seems like this all kind of revolves around Bell's inequalities, and other authors he's debating, especially in, I guess he starts in the first paper, Blaylock and Maudlin. He's comparing this theory against some of their ideas, and the debate seems to be about whether there's locality or non-locality in quantum mechanics, and whether there's counterfactual definiteness, which was a term that I hadn't seen before, which simply means that real and deterministic local quantum states exist before you measure them. I like that idea. That's a lot nicer than the wave function collapse idea.
There's a lot that this has going for it. And the basis of the consistent histories idea is trying to describe quantum mechanics in a way that is consistent with probability theory, with conditional probabilities. I'd already thought that conditional probabilities were sort of the basis for quantum theory in the first place. The bracket notation people use in quantum mechanics, if you put a P in front of a bracket, which is basically two state vectors, the one on the left is the new state, the one on the right is the old state. If you just put a P in front of that, then all of a sudden you have people would normally think of as a symbol for a conditional probability. It's not the probability in quantum mechanics, it's the square root of the probability, basically. But still, quantum mechanics has always looked to me like probability, like conditional probabilities. What this guy is doing with those conditional probabilities is trying to construct sets of possible histories. And each of one of those histories is given a probability. And you construct those possible histories with quantum mechanics, going from point to point to point to point, using some sort of operator at each particular point. So your set of histories is constructed through a overarching set of operators. Operators often being measurements, but basically they just mean if I apply this operator to my wave function, then I get a number, and that number tells me what the value of this thing is at this point. Each one of those operators is a projector case, which means that it's in an eigenstate of the system. If I measure over here, I'm going to measure this property in this direction or this position or something like that. For example, for a spin operator, you say I'm going to measure SZ at time T2. What you get is whether or not the spin is aligned or anti-aligned with the magnetic field you put on at time T2, whether the magnetic moment is aligned or anti-aligned with the magnetic field at that time T2. So the field is measuring the moment, or not necessarily measuring the moment, but the field is giving a direct value to the magnetic moment, to the magnetic moment at each one of those places where those projectors are given. At that point, I don't think anybody can have too much of an issue with it. Maybe there's some issues here and there, but up to that point at least, just constructing these frameworks, these sets of different histories, I don't think most people would have a problem with that part of this theory or this part of this interpretation.
Isn't it common at this point to believe that the particle doesn't exist in any specific state until it's detected? Isn't that the prevailing model?
Well, I mean, if you look at something like one of these Copenhagen objective interpretations or very instrumentalist interpretations, then you're saying not that the particle doesn't exist, but it doesn't exist in a definite state until there's a measurement. So yes, somebody might have an objection that you can't do this, that, or the other thing. On the other hand, there's no reason why they have to add in all these different projectors. If you just have a projector at the preparation state and at the measurement state, if those are the only places where you think you can make that measurement, the only place where you have those values available, where those values are real, then that's perfectly fine. And that's still a way to construct these frameworks. So we haven't yet talked about how the frameworks are constructed. We're just saying that they have all of these projectors in them. And a measurement is a kind of projector. The thing about the consistent histories, at least according to Griffiths, is that he's allowed to put those projectors in just anywhere in that history. And there, yes, you're going to get some arguments. And especially you're going to get some arguments where you put a projector between your preparation and your measurement of the same thing that your measurement is going to do. And Griffiths is saying that you can put that projector in there and use it as a let's suppose I did the measurement of the spin right after the spin comes out of the magnetic field, and let's suppose I do it right before it goes into the magnetic field. So now he's saying that that projector has a definite value even though you're not making the measurement, and people are going to not like that.
Yeah, but that's why I do like it.
And the thing they're especially not going to like is that Griffiths is going to say the value of that projector before the object goes into the magnetic field is going to be the same one that comes out afterwards, as long as, of course, they're the same projector. They're both like the spin in the Z direction, in the direction the magnetic field is pointing. So in a way, in a very real way, Griffith's interpretation is realist. It's saying that quantum mechanical particles always have all of these properties, or your quantum mechanical particles always have properties. Seeing that they always have all of these properties is going to be a problem. That's where people are going to have problems with this in general. That's where the big problems with this are going to show up.
Well, he seems to even refute that idea at the end, though, of the second paper. It seems like he was saying that they're throwing away this idea of unicity, that at any given instant, everything in the universe has a definite state. And he's saying that that's not the case, that you have to throw that out for his theory. How does that work?
What that's saying is that you don't have to describe everything in terms of any particular projector. There are situations, and there are situations where it won't matter, where you can put a projector in, like the spin in the X direction or the spin in the Y direction at the same spot. Now, you can't say those two things simultaneously. You can't make those two measurements simultaneously. Those two measurements do not commute. But you could do either one anytime you want to. That's your choice.
And that seems like that was kind of the bedrock of his idea, is that there is a classical bias to the idea that all of the various spin components, for example, will commute in classical physics. And he's saying that that prejudice, that classical prejudice, was built into the derivations of Bell's inequality, which is why it's wrong, which is fascinating to me because, you know, normally we look at these violations of Bell's inequality as proof of quantum weirdness. He's saying, no, the problem is with the Bell's inequality itself and that it seems to have this precondition assumption that these variables are going to commute and they don't. So he says, you've got to reformulate your prediction because those aren't matching, and that's why it seems like there's a discord. And I'd never heard anything like that before. I always thought that Bell's inequality was bulletproof. It's really interesting to see him take a look at this and line up the predictions with the results.
So yeah, a lot of what he's doing is he's talking about something in the realm of quantum logic. That's part of the reason why you have this counterfactual definiteness stuff showing up. That's also, I'm not sure, I think in both of these papers, I also read two other papers, one by Maudlin and one of the ones that he's arguing with here. You know, going through these, there's a lot of talk about what's basically quantum logic and the problem with the distributive law in multiplication, and that it just doesn't work if you have non-commuting variables like the spin in the X and the spin in the Y direction.
Mm-hmm. He says those just aren't defined because they don't commute in quantum logic, so that's why there's a false assumption that they should, you know.
So what he's saying is that sometimes when you use and in discourse, you know, you're using it in an invalid manner. And that's what this single framework rule is about. He's saying that You have to be very careful about when you construct these frameworks, or you have to be very careful that whenever you're talking in a single framework, a single set of histories where all of the projectors commute. And if you have two different frameworks, two different sets of histories that you want to talk about, only if you can combine all of those projectors so that they all commute, each projector in each one of these two frameworks commutes, then you can make a larger framework wherein you can talk about the entire thing. Otherwise, you can't talk about it at all.
Is that right to say that Bell wasn't using that logic when he formulated the inequality, and that's why it deviates from the experiment?
I'm not sure. I mean, the thing about Bell's inequality is basically saying, okay, let's take some regular old logic, or let's take some regular old probability and figure out what would happen in a couple of situations. What happens if our states are all parallel? What happens if our states are all orthogonal? And then what happens when our states are somewhere in the middle? And he shows that if you take the quantum mechanical version and you take the classical version, you get a difference. When the angle is not 0 or 90, you get a difference. When it's at 0 and 90, it's all the same. But when you measure SZ and then later on something at an angle like 45 degrees between the Z component and the X component of the spin, then you get a different answer in both of the situations. So there's nothing wrong with those inequalities. What's going on here is you're asking, okay, well, when you calculate these things classically, what is the problem? Where is the problem coming from? Normally, when we talk about what is that problem, what we say is that problem is coming because either locality is breached or causality is breached. So either things are happening faster than the speed of light, locality is breached, or things in the future are making things happen in the past, causality is breached. What Griffiths is saying, it's neither of those. All that's happened is you've talked about two different things that don't really mix, so you've screwed up somewhere that way.
That's one of the things that really caught me, too, about this work is, boy, you know, the idea of entanglement having a spooky action at a distance effect on distant particles, and that you change the state of the other particle when you measure the entangled partner. That's so prevalent now that it's almost a freaking religious foundation of quantum mechanics. But he's saying, no, you don't need to do that. And that's really exciting.
So what he's saying is that for each one of these histories, where you have operators at different times at different angles, if you choose your histories, each property in that history has its value at the interaction point. So when you entangle the particles, at the point where you entangle those particles already have their value in the SZ direction, or their value in the theta direction, whatever that is, between X and Z. And they just keep those the entire time they're along that path.
Yeah, and everything that I've read about this, at the very least, just after the instant when they get separated, I think that he's certain that, or at least he's arguing that they have a definite state. But I was always told that these tests of Bell's inequalities proved that that wasn't the case.
Yeah, that is more or less what everybody was saying. And as long as you're willing to say that if I'm going to measure the theta direction in 3 nanoseconds, whatever it is, however long it takes to get that particle to get to the detector, that particle that I'm measuring in the theta direction does not have a Z component or an X component, only has that theta component, then you can say that the entire interaction was local and deterministic and happened at the point where the two wave functions, the two wave packets, are far enough apart that they can't communicate unless they go faster than the speed of light.
So does this abolish the idea of superposition?
Well, we'll have to talk about that later when we talk about the second thing, because I think that might be an issue with that experiment we were talking about with the Bohmian stuff. At least the way he explains it. It should not have anything to do with superposition. It should not. Although all the stuff I've read have to do with the spin-up, spin-down states, the spin states of the atom, because basically that's easy, because the Hilbert space has two values in it, right, instead of having a continuum of values. But he wrote an entire book on this, and he keeps referring to it. And he says, well, yeah, just read chapters 24 to 27 of my book. And if you do read chapters 24 to 27 of his book, I'm sure he talks about the double slit experiment.
But I mean, even in the entanglement explanation, I was always told that your two entangled photons, for example, were in a superposition, and that when you measured one, then it created a deterministic result, and therefore the other one instantly was the opposite, to conserve spin and so forth.
Yeah, so if you're realistic about the wave function, then that's what happens. So if you're saying the wave function is the state of the system, then the state of that system is in sort of an indeterminate state up until the point you measure it.
Right. So is he looking at the wave function as more of a calculational tool than a physical reality?
Yeah, something like that. I think what he's trying to do for the most part is to replace the idea of the wave function with the idea of these histories and of these frameworks. So that's a part of it. He's trying to use quantum mechanics, the Schrodinger equation, all that other stuff as what he's calling a pre-probability. And so he's trying to say that the math that he's doing is turning those into a calculational tool that's a step removed from reality. And therefore, when you make a measurement or something like that, you're not worried about that wave function or whatever's going on with the Schrodinger equation. You're just worried about which history am I actually in. Now, I think that's an interesting thing to talk about right now is that the strange thing when I was reading Lee Smolin's book is that when he described consistent histories, he described it in a way that sounded a lot like the opposite of the Everett interpretation, of the many worlds interpretation. Rather than like in the many worlds interpretation where it looks like you're unraveling a string, right? Every time you unravel a string, you unravel another string, and so forth and so on. Every time you measure something in the world, whatever a measurement means, get another universe. The way Smolin was describing it, it sounded like there were all of these histories in the world, and your history and my history might be a little bit different, but when we come together, when our histories meet, they sort of coalesce into something that's consistent between the two. And so it sounded like it was just the opposite. Rather than unwinding the string, you're winding the string.
Right. In section 3 of his first paper, a section called Quantum Dynamics, he even explicitly states that he sees the inconsistent histories approach as the opposite of Everett's model. And he says that his model is always stochastic. But then when there's an interaction, it's like the law of physics means that they're consistent together, produce a given result.
That's what I understood with Smolin. That's not what I'm getting from Griffiths. It sounds to me like Griffiths, he's got a system where he's trying to get away from a lot of the stranger things, hiding these things in these histories.
Did you understand his Schrodinger's cat example?
I've forgotten his Schrodinger's cat example by now. So you'll have to describe it.
Well, I mean, he does mention the Schrodinger's cat scenario, which is, you know, such a prevailing motif in quantum mechanics that I thought it might help bring some of this home. I mean, he was saying that choosing a framework with mutually exclusive projectors for a dead cat and an alive cat prohibits a paradox. Something about choosing your histories, choosing which framework you're working in, by definition prohibits there being a cat that's both alive and dead at the same time.
Well, I think what happens is that even though your framework will include both a live cat and a dead cat, any particular real history, any particular history that's there will either have a live cat or a dead cat. So there's no flipping around. It would be inconsistent to have a cat that was alive when you put one of these imaginary projectors in there after 3 hours and dead after 4 hours, and then alive again after 5 hours. So those would be inconsistent set of projectors. So they can't have that history.
So in his model, can you have a cat that's alive and dead at the same time?
No.
Okay.
Or at least he says no.
I've always had a big problem with that idea. I'm sure you can relate.
Yeah, nobody really likes that idea, except when they're really stoned.
And you can't tell whether your cat is alive or dead. It hasn't moved for so long.
So the quantum dynamics I'm a little unsure of. I know he keeps talking about it's completely random, but it does sound like certain projectors aren't allowed. The thing about the inconsistent projectors is that sometimes you're talking about things that are classical, where being alive and being dead are two different sets of histories. And if you think about that classically, you can think about Venn diagrams and say, okay, this thing happens and I draw a little circle around it. Then everything that's not in that circle and the rest of the universe is that thing does not happen. With quantum mechanics, and this is the reason why quantum logic gets so weird, you're using states in a Hilbert space, which are basically lines in that Hilbert space. That's probably a drawing that he had in one of those things. This doesn't really happen with things that are alive and dead or spins that are plus or minus one. Those are still just points. But if you think about position, that's a line in Hilbert space. If you think of momentum, that's a line in Hilbert space. And those things don't commute and they're perpendicular to each other. So your different directions, your different projectors, project lines basically in your Hilbert space. The complement to a projector is perpendicular to it rather than being the rest of all space. So there's still a lot of empty stuff out there, which is pretty much the issue. There's a lot of empty stuff between yes and no. And it doesn't really make a lot of sense to talk about all those other things at that point.
Okay. I'm not sure if I grabbed all of that, but I do remember him saying that the Hilbert space was completely filled up with all of the different rays, I guess, that are created by the various projectors. And that's why it didn't make sense for non-commuting factors to exist in sets. The Hilbert space is completely occupied by these possibilities, so sets of them don't exist in the same way that they do in like a phase space with classical physics, right?
Yeah, that's sort of the way he describes it. And then again, that's the reason why the distributive law doesn't work.
There was a fun comment that he made in the measurements section. Section 4 of the first paper. Apparently, he's got a real problem with the idea that measurements create reality out of nothing. I like that.
Okay, yeah, it is a little bit odd when you start thinking about it, that there's something you can't talk about wandering around between two places, and then all of a sudden it has a definite value that is one of two, and you already knew that it was going to be one of those two.
Well, yeah, the New Age community has really picked up on the idea behind the Copenhagen interpretation, and they're trying to use it to say that we are the gods of reality, and that things only exist when we observe them, and that we make our own reality with our thoughts and all that kind of stuff. You know, I don't believe any of that. It is kind of disturbing that quantum physicists have accidentally created their own worst nightmare in the New Age movement by mystifying reality so much.
Well, I mean, if you look at Wigner's friend, maybe it's not so inadvertent.
Wigner's friend?
It's just one more of these little quantum mechanics paradoxes.
Oh, okay. I've never read that one. Can you explain that to me, the Wigner's friend paradox?
No, I just failed to explain it to you. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to do it right now. I don't remember enough about it. I do know that it has something to do with two different conscious observers interpreting quantum mechanics.
Okay, I'll have to look that up.
Okay, so how far have we talked about it? Have we gotten to the first page, or are we still talking before we talk about the papers?
Oh, I don't know. I'm kind of perusing through the notes here and looking at the end of the first paper. You know, there's some really technical stuff about the EPR correlations and measurements, and then some discussion of locality and counterfactuals. We can go over any of that stuff if you like.
Yeah, I think the thing about the dynamics, one of the things that really gets me is what he's done in a way is to complicate the wave function, to complicate the idea about what's going on by creating a Hilbert space in time. So that's what these sets of projectors are, is they're a time-ordered set of operators, of values. So if you have an entangled state, right, what you have is basically the state of particle A times the state of particle B in this state, or you could say and. And so that would be something like the state vector of 1 minus the state vector of 2 divided by the square root of 2 to keep things normalized. He does this as well in time. So that's where you have this second kind of multiplication symbol. So he'll say, okay, I've got my preparation operator. Then I've got my first projector, my second projector, my third projector, and my measurement. What he's basically doing is he's entangling each one of these states in a history in time. And that's how I understand his dynamics. And I'm not really clear about what all of that means, but that's how these things are working. That's how he's explaining what's actually going on. So you just have to think about things as being in these different states. And I guess there are three important states for this EPR paradox, for describing Bell's theorem. And those are, what is a preparation state, this entangled state? What is the state immediately after they disentangle, immediately upon these two wave packets being far enough away that, you know, light can't do anything with them? And what is the state when you actually measure it? And that middle state is, according to him, always going to be the final state. So you could add projectors all you want in the middle, and those will all still have the same state, as far as I understand it. And that's all this mathematics that he's using with all of these measurements and things is saying.
But that's still big, because, you know, that's been an ongoing debate for decades.
Yeah, and all you have to do is say, if I'm measuring in the Z direction, I'm not allowed to say anything about the X direction, or even at that 45 degree direction.
So this mathematically does resolve the results of Bell's inequality experiments?
What he's shown, as far as I understand it, gives the same results as Bell's inequality would. It does exactly the same thing that Bell's inequality does normally. all he's shown is that if you get rid of this aspect of logic, if you modify this aspect of logic, then you can pretend to have locality and causality at the same time.
Right. And you remove the superluminal signaling aspect and all that business, which is really the thorn in the side anyway.
So anyways, that's more or less what he's showing in that. I'm not sure if it's sufficient. So I don't know if the mathematics he's done here are enough to really protect him the way he says that he's protected. But he's definitely given you a way to talk about these things. You'd still have to give something up. But you might like what you give up more than those other two.
Wait, what are you saying that we have to give up?
You're giving up the ability to say that the particle has an SX component if you're going to measure the SZ.
Oh, I see. But that kind of makes sense, though. I mean, given what quantum mechanics shows us.
Yeah, so you can think of it as being a step back from the Copenhagen interpretation. At one point, he says that this is...
It's Copenhagen interpretation done right.
What he's saying is that you can still talk about things in between, but everything that you talk about has to be consistent in a technical way so that some of these things that you're used to talking about end up not being consistent any longer or end up not being things that you're allowed to talk about. You're allowed to talk about more than what you would be talking about in the Copenhagen interpretation, but less than you really want to be able to.
Oh, right, because we want to be able to talk about, like, spins on two different axes at the same time, but he's saying that that's a non sequitur in quantum logic.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, because we're saying the spin is a vector, the spin has a direction. We should be able to talk about all three of those components.
Okay, and he's saying, no, they're not correlated, so that doesn't make any sense to do it.
And he's saying you can choose any one of those you want to talk about.
But you got to stick with it.
Although there have to be points where you can switch what you're talking about and still have consistent projectors. So you make that SZ measurement, now you can make your SX measurement. You have to be able to talk about that SX measurement later on. So between that SZ measurement and that SX measurement, you can choose to say that after you make that SZ measurement, here's an issue. He's saying that when you measure something, you're measuring the property of the particle that existed just before it. He's also saying that when you measure something right afterwards, or if you put that projector in right afterwards, it's the same as what you measured just before. So that on either side of your measurement, that spin component in the Z direction, let's say, that spin up in the Z direction is the state before and after to make the measurement. But then you have that SX thing, and you make that measurement in a different direction. Now you have to say just before you make that SX measurement and just after that SX measurement, the value of the spin in the X direction for that particle is the same. So somewhere in between those two measurements, you do have to make that switch. And he doesn't explain that, at least in these papers, where you have to make that switch.
But I thought that the spin state got destroyed when you measured it.
Is that what he said in these, or is...
No, I'm not sure if he said that in there, but I thought that was just the nature of taking a measurement, was that you measure the spin of a photon, then that spin is destroyed in the measurement, or changed, or something, right? Isn't there some kind of interaction that would randomize it?
Normally in quantum mechanics, what you'd say is, when you take that measurement, afterwards it's in the SZ direction. So remember with the Stern-Gerlach experiment, if I do a SZ measurement, have my beam of silver baryons going through my metal, silver atoms maybe, and then half of them go between my magnet and up, half of them go between my magnet and down. Half of them are aligned, half of them are anti-aligned. Then I do my SZ measurement on that beam that went up. All of them are going to be aligned with the magnet.
And they're going to stay that way until they reflect or something.
Yeah, you could do that for 20 different Stern-Gerlach experiments in a row, and they'd all be exactly the same. But, and this is another reason why I was talking about that SX experiment, is if you turn that second projector 90 degrees to the X direction, then the thing that used to be in the Z direction, the thing that used to be spin up in the Z direction, the thing that was spin up Z direction comes in, gets that SX measurement, and you go to a third SZ measurement, or a second SZ measurement after that SX measurement, it goes through there and it's going to do 50-50 SZ. So that non-commuting measurement randomizes the original state. Part of the reason why I chose this consistent quantum measurements to talk about is because it was talking about Stern-Gerlach measurements. Unfortunately, he's only talking about that first Stern-Gerlach measurement. He's not talking about that series. And that series is the one that's actually interesting. That series of three, SZ, SX, SZ, that's the interesting one that I want to see how it's actually explained.
Yeah, I'd like to see that too.
Because that would tell me what's really going on. what he's done doesn't really tell me very much. I think it's completely consistent and it makes a lot of sense and I like it. I like the way he's thinking about this, but it doesn't tell me as much as I think it would tell me to go through that three Stern Gerlach set.
Yeah, I assume, based on the type of thinking he's employing here, that he's saying that for each of the spin states along each axis, that they'd all have a definite value from the time that they were created. But he doesn't go through that. It would have been nice if he would have looked at perpendicular axes so that you could really see it play out.
You see, the difficulty I have is in that in-between time, in between like the SX and the SZ measurements. Let's see if I can try to figure this out. I don't think I'm going to figure it out, but let me see if I can. We've got the beam of atoms coming in, and they have these states. And we can, coming into that first SZ measurement, we can say it's either in the SZ or the minus SZ state. Or it's in the plus state or the minus state. It goes in there, and then it comes out, and it's in one of those states, let's say the plus SZ state. Somewhere, we have to switch our framework. Somewhere in there, our framework has to start using these SX states before we get to that measurement. Because, at least according to these papers that we've been reading, what we want to do is we want to say that whatever we measure in that SX direction, we want to say that that is the state beforehand. So somewhere in there, we have to switch our, I don't think it's switching our framework. We have to use a framework where we stop using the Z and start using the X states. And somewhere in there, there should be something going on where we actually do the quantum mechanical math to choose the SX state from the SZ state.
Huh, I thought that's what he was forbidding. I thought that he was saying that you can look at these independent spin states with separate consistent histories. Since they're non-correlated, you can't fuse them together.
That is a question I've had several times, is I'm not sure, do you have to just measure SZ states the whole way through? Or do all of your projectors have to be SZ projectors? I don't think so. I think probably you're allowed to use any combination of those projectors, X, Z, Y, total spin, angular momentum, whatever, so long as they're in positions where you can't count them as having the same state in the same time, so long as they're far enough away relativistically. So I think you have to be able to switch from one projector to another somewhere. And at that point, you have to use your quantum mechanics to do the randomization again. That might be something that's relevant from that EPR paper. You know, I don't really see that in the EPR paper, because in the EPR paper, I see the history staying consistent for each one. So that's really not enough for me to make a decision about what he's saying based on that.
Yeah, I don't think he got into that in the second paper either.
I know he didn't. I'd read through section 6 and I was saying, okay, we've only got like 5 pages left. He's going to get to this in section 7. And then it was, oh no, we're back to talking about the first and second measurement problems again. So anyways, that was what I got out of that. Is there anything else that you were interested in this?
Well, I wanted to mention this again. He uses this quote that his theory is Copenhagen done right, but that just sounds like marketing to me. Like he's trying to appeal to the general physics community, but because it seems like he's abandoning the fundamental interpretation that Copenhagen is all about, this idea of objective deterministic reality.
You're saying that because he thinks that we have an objective deterministic reality.
Pre-measurement. Right.
You're saying that what he's saying is that this is not Copenhagen's all subjective in some manner.
You know, with Copenhagen, the basic tenet is that the state doesn't actually exist in a real form until it's measured. Like, that's kind of the basis of that interpretation as I understand it. And he seems to have a completely different view. So I don't see how he can invoke the Copenhagen interpretation as a sibling of this theory.
Yeah, I don't really think that this is very Copenhagen-y. But I think the reason why he was saying that was for the rationale I was saying previously, is that the Copenhagen interpretation gives you very severe restrictions about what you can say exists between measurements. That is, you can't say anything. He's saying that you can say something.
Oh, but you can't do it between or uncorrelated measurements.
Well, you can't talk about two measurements that would be inconsistent.
Okay.
Or two possible measurements that would be inconsistent.
Okay, now I understand. That does make sense. There is a certain logical familiarity there. Let's see, what else does he talk about here? He poops on the spontaneous localization theory and the many worlds interpretation.
Spontaneous localization sounds interesting. I don't know enough about it. That's basically, there's some sort of decay time with your state. So you have your interaction, you have your entanglement, then the entanglement decays with some time that has to be fairly long, but it's not instantaneous, but it decays into a pure state eventually. That sounds fairly interesting. Again, I don't know much about it. He does not seem to like the many worlds interpretation.
Well, welcome to the club.
And he's got the general thing that I think we both dislike, which is the universe keeps splitting. What are you actually explaining when you just keep saying the universe keeps splitting?
Yeah, it's just the opposite of Occam's razor. It's like, okay, well, we're going to have an infinite number of universes and don't want to explain this one.
And then he talks about why he doesn't like Bohmian mechanics.
Oh, that was an interesting example. Let's talk about that a little bit. The Wheeler's Gedanken experiment.
Yeah, so we can't talk about this very much because the description isn't very long. What's happening here is you have a two-slit experiment with two detectors, right? So you have a double-slit experiment with two detectors. You have an upper slit and an upper detector, a lower slit, a lower detector. You've got plane waves coming into the object that you have the slits in, and then you're going to measure on that detector.
Well, and the neat thing is in this scenario, you've got the detector on the bottom is pointing at the slit on the top. And the detector at the top is pointing at the slit on the bottom, so the waves have to pass through a common point before they reach the other detector.
Yeah, what they're saying is that the particles should either go in straight lines directly towards either of these detectors, and there's a point directly in between. He's saying your normal intuition is that if a particle goes through A, if the particle goes through the top slit, then it has to be angled towards the bottom slit for the detector to detect it, and the opposite for the lower slit. The lower slit has to be angled towards the upper slit, and there's that spot in the middle. Normally, somebody would say this is how you'd get there. For a classical particle, if it was going to be able to get to that detector on the bottom, it would do it through the hole on the top. That's sort of the naive classical picture. And he says that this is exactly what his interpretation is going to give you in this case. He's saying with a Bohmian particle, the more likely thing is that if you have this detector above, the upper detector, the upper slit is where it's most likely going to come from. That somehow in there, there's a wave crest or something at that point X that's reflecting the particle.
Right, and so it bounces.
There are a couple of things here, and this is what I talked about at the top of the podcast, is when I said we'd get back to this.
Nice closure.
Is that if you do have that vacuum substratum, this is perfectly fine. What Bohm is doing, that's perfectly fine. If you have an empty vacuum, if you have a classical vacuum, if you say the vacuum means there's nothing there, then there is nothing to bounce off of. But if you've already said that what I'm going to do is I'm going to have some sort of thing in a vacuum, you know, doing my wavy bits, then this doesn't really turn into a negative. There's another complication, though. If you look at the next page, there's a fellow by the name of Englert, and he did a number of numerical simulations. And he said if you numerically put in a completely non-destructive detector on one of these paths, in the Bohmian detector, something can go off of A, go all the way down to the detector coming out of B, or you can have the particle go through the upper slit, go down to the detector that's in front of the lower slit, and then go up through the center of, and then into the top detector.
That sounds really improbable.
He says it can happen. He doesn't say what the probabilities are.
Then they have to postulate a non-interacting detector, which is kind of a fiction.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all numerical simulations. It's a complete fiction. I mean, this would be fun to see if you could actually make this experimental setup. See what happens, especially when you start talking about some of those very strange trajectories we were talking about a couple of months ago.
With a triple slit experiment, yeah.
So we already have this idea from quantum electrodynamics that quantum mechanical particles do not go in straight lines.
In that case, there was a plasmon interaction, though, with a metal screen with slits in it.
That was just to enhance the not straight lininess.
Okay, so it happens with any material, but it's so subtle you couldn't detect it.
Yeah, it's small enough that it's hard to detect. That's just for that really near field where it's doing that thing where it's spinning around and going in, out, and back in again. If you take the integrals in quantum electrodynamics seriously, then the reason why you get all these interference patterns is because the particles get to walk around in whatever way they want to. remember, you turn down the gain on your electron gun, you only have one electron going through it at a time, and you still get those interference patterns. The electron is not going in a straight line. It's wandering around in some crazy fashion, however it likes to go. It's just that some paths are much, much more likely than others. How this actually applies to this interpretation, I don't know. That's always been the problem. That's always been the problem with quantum interpretations, is that you're usually interpreting non-relativistic quantum mechanics. That leads to some problems because you're not using all the tools of relativistic quantum mechanics.
I wish there was some way to conduct this experiment.
There probably is if somebody gives me enough money.
Call them up. Do you have a Patreon yet, Jim?
Thanks to this, there will be a Patreon up by the time I finish editing this podcast.
Fantastic.
We'll see what we can do with that.
It does seem like that would be a really difficult experiment to engineer, though. I wonder if you could use like that weak measurement process.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, is using some sort of weak measurement idea through it. I mean, you still have this issue that it's weak measurements, but I mean, you have to do something like that. You have to use the weak measurements to get some idea out of that. Now you're back to Aharonov, who invented this.
Yeah, he's pretty brilliant. Maybe you can call him up and work on that.
Well, he probably doesn't know how to do it because he's a theorist.
Didn't he come up with a measurement of the vector potential of the magnetic field that was so awesome? Oh, it's an idea. It hasn't been tested.
Well, if you remember what you had to do to put that together.
Yeah, you needed like a quantum system, basically.
You needed these, you know, freely rotating cylinders that were half a nanometer in size or something like that. I don't know exactly how small they'd have to be, but they'd have to be tiny. To get a simple Gedanken experiment, you know, you have to do things that can't really happen in the real world. Otherwise, somebody would just do the experiment. Look how long it took with the EPR thing before you got the aspect experiment.
All right. I guess I won't hold my breath for this one.
No, go ahead. You see how long it...
Thanks, Jim.
See how blue you can get, all right?
All right.
Okay, got anything else?
I think that was it.
All right, well then, let's sign off. Thanks for talking, Randy.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate your insight.
Okay, bye now.
Bye.